Yesterday, the Hawaii Supreme Court, as part of the Courts in the Community program, heard a case that brings to the fore some of the key issues surrounding marriage equality. Should the parental rights and obligations of same-sex and heterosexual couples be the same? The circumstances of the case are these. A lesbian couple agreed to have a child conceived through assisted reproduction. When the marriage fell apart, the non-birth mother claimed she was not responsible for child support, having no biological relationship to the child. Lambda Legal argues otherwise, and we spoke with its senior attorney, Peter Wren, just after yesterday's hearing.
It's essentially a case involving the rights and responsibilities of same-sex married parents. Mm-hmm. And the question before the court today was, essentially, can a same-sex couple who is married both be the legal parents to the child that they agreed to have? Mm-hmm. And we think the answer to that question is yes. So that's sort of, in a nutshell, the legal question before the court. The case itself involves a married lesbian couple who decided to have a child together through donor insemination during their marriage, and then they subsequently broke up. Mm-hmm. And so the question is whether or not the birth mother's spouse is presumed to be a legal parent to that child, even though she doesn't have a biological connection to that child. Mm-hmm. And so we argued today to the Supreme Court that the marital presumption of parentage applies fully to same-sex spouses. So just as in the case of a heterosexual married couple, if a woman gives birth, her husband is presumed to be the legal father. And we think that rule should apply equally to same-sex spouses.
What was the other woman's argument?
So we represent the biological mother in this case, who we refer to as Dee Dee in the court argument. Mm-hmm. The non-biological mother is Cece. And Cece's argument was that you essentially have to have a biological connection with a child in order to be deemed a legal parent under the Hawaii Uniform Parentage Act. And we argued that legal parentage does not reduce to a matter of biology. And we know that in the context of donor insemination. So let's say we have a heterosexual married couple, and the husband's wife becomes pregnant through donor insemination. Even though the husband is not legally related to the child, the law presumes that he is a legal father. And so we're just asking the court to recognize that same principle applies to same-sex couples. We absolutely think that with equal rights come equal responsibilities. So much of the movement for equality has been about treating same-sex couples equally as different sex couples. And that's true not just for the rights, but it's also true for the responsibilities. So if someone makes the decision to become a parent, then they get all of the rights of parentage, but they also get all the responsibilities of parentage. And the law doesn't let you just shirk the legal consequences of your actions. So in this case, even though the non-biological mother ultimately decided that she didn't want to be a part of the child's life, she made the choice with the birth mother to have the child in the first place. And that means she's also responsible for child support.
Was the non-biological mother part of her argument that being a lesbian created a special circumstance different than if she were a male?
Absolutely. So the non-biological mother's argument was that there essentially is no situation really in which a same-sex couple can both be the parents to their child because they can't both be genetically the parents to that child. Mm-hmm. And so they were, we think, creating basically a special and different rule than the one we normally use for heterosexual couples. And that's really unfair to the children that are conceived as a result. You know, a child who has same-sex parents should have all of the same rights and protections that we extend to children who have different sex parents.
Are you finding in your work with Lambda Legal Defense that more cases like this are emerging?
I think we have always seen that for every piece of progress that we make, there are always attempts to try to roll that back. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, some of it does originate sort of within our own community. So this is, in some sense, not a new fight that we're having. There have been a number of cases where typically it's the biological mother who tries to use biology against a non-biological mother to say, when they break up, you're not a parent. You don't have any rights to custody or to visitation. Mm-hmm. Here it's a slight twist on that sort of old dispute where it's actually the non-biological mother who's trying to use biology as a shield against the responsibilities of child support. So you can use biology either as a sword or as a shield. The bottom line is it's not right. It's not how families are formed. It's not the basis for love and commitment. And that's really the principle that we hope that the court affirms in ruling for our client.
And this is a decision that is pending in the Supreme Court. And you've argued before them today, this morning. I'm wondering what kind of questions, you could sometimes get an indication from the court by what kind of questions the justices ask you. What did they want to know?
I think the Supreme Court justices were very interested to know of the other side why it was that the marital presumption of parentage shouldn't apply equally to same-sex spouses. And they were particularly focused on a U.S. Supreme Court case that came out earlier this year. So in that case, the Supreme Court reversed Arkansas's refusal to list both same-sex spouses on a child's birth certificate. And they wanted to know, how is this case different from that? And our argument has been, it's really not different at all. The bottom line is that if a state presumes that a married couple are both the parents to the child, that principle has to extend equally to same-sex couples. So I think they seem to understand that argument, and we're cautiously optimistic that they'll ultimately adopt it in their final ruling.
It sounds as if a lot of the weight of the law is based on the welfare of the child, as in guaranteeing that no matter what happens to the parental relationship, the child will have support, at least financial support, from two parents no matter what.
That's absolutely a major thrust of the law. And, you know, again, we're only asking for the same rules to be applied for same-sex couples as are applied to different-sex couples. So we definitely don't want a situation where, regardless of whether it's a heterosexual couple or a same-sex couple, that one parent can just walk away from their commitments. So if a parent has agreed to have a child through donor insemination, then they should have to bear the legal consequences of those choices that they made. And it's not fair to the child that just because a marriage or relationship subsequently deteriorated, that they don't have the support of two parents.
Prior to legalizing same-sex marriage, the parent in this case could have walked away without consequences.
I think that was often a litigated issue, but certainly one of the main harms of not having marriage is that there wasn't sort of a set of rules that reliably could protect the child in that situation. You know, would the non-biological parent have a right to still see that child, to visit that child? Those were hard issues, and courts, you know, sometimes found ways to still reach the right result at the end of the day. But having marriage equality certainly makes it easier, more predictable in terms of how those disputes are resolved.
But prior to marriage equality, it seems to me, from the circumstances you described, that it would have been easier for a parent who didn't want further involvement with the child to walk away.
I think that's fair. And likewise, even if they wanted to be a part of the child's life after a breakup, the biological parent could often use the absence of a biological relationship as a weapon against that other parent. And that wasn't fair, and it wasn't in the best interest of the child. So I do think that marriage equality, a major benefit of it, is that it helps the welfare of children. And the principle that we're asking the court to recognize is that you get both the rights and the responsibilities. You can't just pick the one you like and leave the rest behind.
You're really kind of entering into a new legal arena post same-sex marriage, it would seem.
You know, I think some of these issues have come up before, but we're seeing them for the first time materialize in the context of same-sex couples. But I think a reliable principle that courts have really stuck to is that you bear the consequences of your actions, you know? And here, the family court below found that this was a joint decision by the couple to have a child. And so it's perfectly fair that both of them are deemed the legal parents at the end of the day.
Peter Wren is Lambda Legal's senior attorney. The case of CC versus DD was heard yesterday at the Castle Performing Arts Center as part of the Courts in the Community program, the Hawaii Supreme Court's educational program that gives high school students hands-on experience in the way the Hawaii judicial system works. We'll be right back. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, a year-end update from Planned Parenthood. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're putting on our hiking boots to explore a national tropical botanical park near Hana on the Valley Isle. As we start our trek, the silhouette of Haleakala looms against the sky. We pass a clearing and an enormous grove of breadfruit trees. Continuing, we pass numerous coconut palms towering above us, and on either side are bright varieties of sugarcane stalks, variegated banana, purple leaves of sweet potatoes, with yellow sap oozing from the seed of a milo tree. Ahead, we catch sight of one of the largest and best-preserved heiau in the state. The structure was built in several stages, beginning as early as the 13th century. The Mackay-facing walls are made up of multiple stepped terraces. The interior is made of 8 lesser walls, 3 enclosures, 5 platforms, 2 upright stones, and 30 pits. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this heiau? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Magnolia Boutique and Gallery in Kahala Mall, offering art from more than 50 Hawaii artists, featuring original art and prints, hand-turned wooden bowls, jewelry, and more. Open daily.
Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands operates 27 health centers in Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, and Western Washington, and deals with a few legal issues of its own: abortion access, birth control coverage in employer health plans, and immigration issues among them. Chris Charbonneau is its CEO, and she's with us to look at the past year and look ahead to the next one. Hi, Chris. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Was this a rocky year in terms of feeling a bit beleaguered?
It was surreal. I think it was surreal for everybody, though, not just us. But Planned Parenthood was very much in the eye of the tornado. And so we appreciated everything everyone did to help us all year. We can't believe that we've come out not damaged, but in many ways augmented.
After numerous calls for your complete dissolution, right?
Absolutely. There were efforts made to not only take health insurance away from 33 million people in the country, but to make sure that Planned Parenthood couldn't collect any money for the services we were providing low-income people who were using Medicaid as their payer source. Fortunately, those things failed one after the other and were part of the reason that the ACA dismantling could not happen.
What were the stated reasons for going after you that way?
They didn't even bother putting lipstick on that pig, really. They were pretty clear that this was out of hatred for the organization and it was meat for their base. It ended up getting them into some trouble when the Senate parliamentarian said, sorry, you can't make a law that goes after one organization. So in a fairly cynical way, they sort of cast around for somebody else they could throw into the same pot, and they were willing to take another completely unrelated organization down by the same tactics just to get at us. And it didn't pass, fortunately, because not only did all 48 Democratic senators stay together, but the two Republican women and John McCain, very famously at the end, voting against the ACA dismantling and the Planned Parenthood defund.
It's still a pretty close call.
It was one vote. It was way too close for comfort. And so I think that we have to be vigilant every single day.
That one vote might not be forthcoming the next time around. And you know.
Right. And today we're going to watch probably a tax bill get either passed or very close to passed, which actually does not hurt Planned Parenthood this time, but it could be very damaging to low-income people needing to get health insurance. So We can talk about it more when we're talking about what is coming up, but we want to make sure that everyone in Hawaii is protected from that eventuality.
Well, we're seeing a number of things being proposed against which there is a hue and cry mm-hmm. in the population, mm-hmm. and yet they're going ahead anyway.
Right. And I think they are likely to pay a very steep price for that in the midterm elections in 2018. So I expect to see some of these shenanigans reversed or dealt with. And I hope we all remember who started it in the first place, because when taxes, tax cuts, and I have that in air quotes, hard to see on the radio, but get rolled back, sometimes people think, wow, they're charging me more. But remember what a sham this is, everybody, because I hope it happens. It's damaging to us today, low-income people today, and it's damaging to our children and grandchildren.
Well, even absent the political fallout, mm-hmm. you know, the expected or potential political fallout mm-hmm. in the next year's election, a lot of people are, you know, never mind what happens in the election, a lot of people are going to be hurt or affected, shall we put it that way, between now and then. What
Absolutely.
Happens to them?
Terrible, terrible. And so I would say that there's been a lot of attention given to Planned Parenthood. It's incredibly important to remember all the other smaller, less visible organizations that help people all day long, the people who provide food for people, the shelters, the people who take care of various health care problems and all of that. If you can remember them all in this holiday season, it would be very important to do.
Well, they're feeling beleaguered, too.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. But with far less platform than Planned Parenthood has in many yeah. ways. And so, you know, it's hard to name everybody, but there's so many people that are connected in this web of our society that help people not fall into these holes that are being very deliberately created we just all need to be neighbors.
Well, when you're under kind of an existential threat from mm-hmm. highly placed mm-hmm. elected sources, you know, chosen by the people, right? Who do you turn to mm-hmm. survive?
Well, all the other people. As it turns out, many of us voted with the majority. More than 10 million people voted for candidates other than the one who is currently the president of the United States. So it's no kind of popular mandate that these folks are acting on. And they can be told by people that it's not okay. I was watching the net neutrality issues happen yesterday and the day before. And all the states, including Hawaii, that are coming together to say, we're going to make sure that you just don't hand the ability to learn about things and be communicated to a small group of big corporate interests. We're going to make sure that in our state laws, those big corporate interests have to comply with our local rules. And good for the states. I have been proud of Hawaii and the other progressive states over and over again as states have exerted their force to defend us against some of the things happening in this administration.
Well, but that's kind of an example. Opposition aside, net neutrality just got iced.
Yes, yes.
In spite of all that
Weirdly
opposition.
Enough, put in the hands of five people, three Republicans and two Democrats, as opposed to maybe more of a utility kind of arrangement. But, you know, I mean, live and learn about this. I think that with the Alabama results showing that people are as activated as they were during the Women's March the day after the election, people are turning out in droves. People are turning out at President Obama level rates to make their voices known. People of color, especially, very inclusive coalition between all the different progressives and people who are likely to get the short end of these sticks. I have a huge amount of hope that we can not only see that wave happen over the next piece of the year, but that things like the gerrymandering and the district engineering that happen in some places to make it so that it takes a whole lot more of some kinds of people to get a vote through than others, those things get corrected, as President Obama had said he was going to put some shoulder to that. I'm grateful for him doing that in his retirement.
Well, Chris, there's a picture that you're creating of increasingly us versus them mm-hmm. society,
mm-hmm.
Increasingly polarized. I don't think too many people would even disagree with that,
yeah.
But it also, we've seen a lot of cases where even with a hue and cry against a policy,
mm-hmm.
it goes through anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It does go through, but the support isn't there. When you look at the polling on things like this tax cut, mm-hmm. the negatives are huge, and you're just sort of thinking, "Wow!" I mean, it's never been clearer that the people are not being served here. And I think the good news about the division is that when the people all really get served, they'll be happy about it. There are a whole lot of folks in the middle of the country in the southern states with huge buyer's remorse that they thought that in some of these candidates they would getting people who would help them. And they are reaping absolutely the opposite, and they feel betrayed. And I'd like to think that what is happening out of this is the death's throw of some of that selfish kind of, get rich quick on the backs of other Americans thing. And what we will go into as a collective is a community of people who really honestly care about each other and care about each other's welfare, and that we have a way to talk to each other about the difficult compromises that come with that.
Chris, let's talk a year from now and see how we did. How's that sound?
Absolutely. Happy to do it. I hope I'm right.
I hope you're here.
I absolutely intend to be here. Planned Parenthood's here to stay.
Thanks a lot. Christine Charbonneau is the CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands, which operates 27 health centers in Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, and Western Washington. Is this what you call triple jeopardy? Federal officer Christopher Deedy is going to face yet another trial for the 2011 shooting death of Colin Eldredge by order of the Hawaii Supreme Court. Deedy's case has so far produced two mistrials, but the Honolulu prosecutor's office is determined to forge ahead. Nick Gruby has more in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning, Nick.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
This doesn't happen very often, does it, going to the well a third time? I was trying to think of any precedents for it.
Well, it's unique, and I think in this sense it's unique given the high-profile nature of the case. Now, I have talked to people who have said that, yes, there have been opportunities, or the prosecutors have taken certain charges or back to trial a few times due to various mistakes. But, I mean, this is a case that we're talking about the prosecuting attorney's office failing twice in securing a murder conviction, and after the first time saying there's absolutely no evidence of reckless manslaughter or any of these lower charges that they are now interested in pursuing. And that's what I think makes this case really strange.
Well, because some of the charges originally lodged have since been discredited by the prosecutors themselves, right?
Well, I mean, it's actually by the jurors. The original charge was second-degree murder, and the first time the jury deadlocked on that because the judge in the case, Judge Karen Ahn, said there's absolutely no evidence of any of these other lower charges, including manslaughter, reckless manslaughter. And the prosecuting attorney's office agreed with her at that time. But so then the second time around when they went to trial, he was charged with second-degree murder again. And in that case, the jury had actually acquitted Christopher Deedy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so this third trial is interesting. And to some of the legal observers I've talked to, they say it's somewhat problematic that the prosecuting attorney's office, after saying there's no evidence of these that these lower offenses should apply to this case, are now reversing themselves and going toward that, in that direction.
Nick, that's what I meant. In a sense, they've undermined their own case by this waffling over secondary murder v. manslaughter approach. Yeah,
right. I think so, and I think in some ways you can see why. I mean, we're talking about a federal agent who's killed somebody, and I think that there is this genuine sense that somebody should pay for that, even if it is an assault charge or in any way, shape, or form. And I actually think the Hawaii Supreme Court also realized that and kind of dodged on this entire issue. And, you know, they had their resident public defender, Associate Justice Richard Pollack, write the opinion. But there was also a dissent. And that dissent said what a lot of these other legal experts who've looked at the case are saying, and that this is patently unfair.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out, Nick. And thanks for pursuing this story. We'll be in touch about this, I'm sure.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Nick Gruby.
If you're a child of the 80s, maybe the 90s, you probably spent some of your teenage years on AOL Instant Messenger. The best part, though...
Beach Babe XOX.
Sick Man 9483.
Banana Laser 874.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Oh, the screen names. Next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director, and at this point in our show every Friday, we check in with him to see what the news department is getting up to. Bill, we've done many stories about homelessness, but it's remarkable how many sub-stories emerge, isn't it?
No, it's true, and it's one of those continuing areas that you cover, and there are different aspects of this, and you can report it from the streets, you can report it from the halls of policymakers,
yeah.
Legislators, all of that. And,
yeah.
And as we know, new legislative session coming, so again, the question, not for the first time and certainly not for the last, what about homelessness? What can be done? So within that sort of setup, the Hawaii Interagency Council on Homelessness is meeting this coming week.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is one of those groups. People, sometimes you hear different government groups and listings and gatherings and who all is involved in this. This is one of the big ones that also brings in folks from neighbor islands as well. So that they actually meet out by the airport for one thing. But
mm-hmm.
They'll be talking about again, looking ahead to the legislative session, one area that's going to come up, safe zones. As you know, and we've talked about here
sure.
on the show, and Hawaii Island looking at an early version of some of that. And again, we don't know what specifically is going to come out of this. Wayne Yoshioka is going to be there and give us an eye to what happened, but also with perhaps a bit of a tilt forward looking ahead to the ledge.
One of the things that we hear all the time is there's no one solution. It's going to be a collection of solutions from a collection of sources. And this sounds as if those sources are going to get together. And
well, it's true. And at some point, again, a great point that you got to get down to specificity.
Yeah.
So at some point, we'll be looking for that as well. Yeah.
And we're hearing some rumblings in the air travel area, aren't we?
Yeah. So a new airline coming to Honolulu.
Right.
Ooh, Scoot. It's a Singaporean airline. It's actually a subsidiary of Singapore Air. Tiger Airways was folded into this, and they have their first flight coming. And so, of course, the Hawaii Tourism Authority people will be out at the airport saying, yay, yay, come more. I'm interested in one aspect of this story, which is it's going to set up for a comparison of airports. Singapore, Changi Airport, which is one of the best in the world, and the Honolulu Airport, not to talk stink, but probably not one of the best in the world. But Singapore, you can get a massage. You can go to a first-run movie. They even have a swimming pool available. And,
I got to see.
But also in terms of efficiency, it's a very efficient operation. So I'm hoping some of that may rub off on the home team. But
right.
We'll see how that goes.
Well, I wouldn't hold my breath. But you've also got a story about a different kind of transportation, Bill.
Back to the voyaging canoe. Hokulea on the west side this past weekend now, Waianae's own voyaging canoe, Ku'uwehi Hiraishi, taking a look at that and about the comeback of community voyaging canoes around the islands, and this one in particular, and there's an interesting story behind that, and she'll have that as
it's
well.
It's remarkable the impact that whole movement has had.
Really true. Worldwide voyage continues to go.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Bill.
You bet.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Healthcare outcomes vary widely in Hawaii from one ethnic group to the next. Native Hawaiians are far more likely to suffer asthma, diabetes, and obesity, and have the highest death rate of all. The University of Hawaii's John A. Burns School of Medicine has been awarded a 5-year, $23 million federal grant to create the Ola Hawaii Center for Research into the Disparities among Hawaii's Ethnic Populations. Earlier this morning, we spoke with Dr. Jairus Hedges, Dean of Medicine at the Med School and project leader, about the project's goals.
One of the things that, of course, is most impressive and of concern is just that there are such significant differences between different collections of people here in Hawaii. A lot of it defined by ethnicity, but also a lot of it by socioeconomic status and geographically where we're situated. Those in rural areas tend to be a little bit more impacted than those in urban areas that have access to care and access to physicians, nurses, and can do more proactively.
Well, the socioeconomic status has an effect on the kind of food that's available to you, for one thing.
That's definitely true. It's not just access to the health care. It's your ability to not only eat better and healthier, but also to get better exercise and to have a little bit of a better outlook on life, which we know there's a strong connection between our immune system and how we age and the worries that we carry with us.
Does this reflect a sort of a more holistic direction that medicine in general is taking?
Absolutely. And this project, I want to reemphasize that it's not just medicine. Now, we have the great pleasure of being sort of the hub for this, but both myself and Dean Noreen Mokuau of the Myron B. Thompson School of Social Work at the University of Hawaii are the PIs, the lead for this. And that alone represents a collaboration, but it's much broader than our two schools.
Which really does represent a move away from, you know, the separate silos, specialty disciplines approach of maybe previous generations.
Absolutely. And those silos are very difficult to break down because we have these structures and these bureaucracies around our particular educational programs that make cross-communication and programs difficult to implement. But we've been working on not only the research side, but also the educational side. And a big part of this project is education and communication with the community and doing it through multiple channels.
Because a lot of these mortality rates, rates of cancer risks, some of the things that contribute to them are quite preventable, I would think.
Sure. Certainly, you know, we're still struggling with the impact of tobacco use, and that's a key thing. And we're learning more and more about the interplay between body mass and obesity and the risk of cancer, as well as a host of other conditions which have a basis in inflammation.
Well, how do you go about deploying $23 million to address some of these issues?
Well, this particular project has multiple components that the money is used to help implement. One is to do some specific projects, and we got some recent media coverage on a project that is a collective working with public health, with the CTAR, the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources at Manoa, and with the Waimanalo Health Clinic. Mm-hmm. That is one small project that is part of this overall effort, but we have both larger projects like the NIH might directly fund through a competitive a call for submissions, and also smaller pilot projects which will lead to those bigger projects. So focus research projects addressing real community needs and proposed solutions to demonstrate the success of those is one element. The other is to develop the future talent that we'll need to address these problems longitudinally. So training future scientists, future community leaders that will work together as teams to address these issues from a scientific and policy basis. And then the third element is to help support some of the tools that we use to complete the research and to help these investigators. And those tools include scientific instruments that are available for doing analysis of genomics and epigenomics, the way that genes are turned on and off, but also some support around statistics and study design. So we have those three components: the research tools, the development of the investigators, and direct support for promising projects that address some of the health disparities in our communities. And that is meant to give us not only something that works today, but something that will work into the future.
I want to address that term you just used, spreading your reach longitudinally, in the sense of broadening the number of professions that are involved beyond the borders of medicine?
Absolutely. It includes not only widening the disciplines that are engaged in these efforts, because we believe synergy is the best way to address the needs of our state, but also to make sure that we are training the next generation, and the next generation, as they are becoming talented scientists in this area, they're used to a climate in which they work together across disciplines to solve problems.
You know, just a couple of the things you've said really make me think that this is a kind of a new century approach, because I think maybe a generation ago at a med school, you might not have heard as much about a holistic approach, longitudinal reach, that kind of thing. Does it seem that way to you?
Absolutely. Now, interestingly, medical schools are being pushed to get out of their comfort zone, which is often kind of self-focused on, you know, training people to practice medicine without seeing the bigger picture of how that medicine connects up with other professions and with the community and with the systems of healthcare delivery. Now, you know, the push is to change that, but a lot of institutions haven't thought about how they were going to do that. They know they have to change, but they don't have a path to do it. We have a very clear path, and we have seasoned people who've been working with our medical school, with our school of social work, for a number of years now, building this new approach.
Ongoing challenge being to keep that funding coming, I would think.
Always a challenge, and we seek to do that in a couple of ways. One, this grant itself is what we call an infrastructure grant, in that it provides the infrastructure for the development of the tools and future investigators, as well as support for specific projects. But given that we have trained new investigators, we've helped launch them, helped them collect what we call pilot or preliminary data, they can then take that information and submit grants of their own, using our grant as sort of the launching pad for that. And the more we can do that, that helps bring funding, federal funding, into our community, and the projects themselves provide care and support and innovation that will help us move the needle further to help us sustain a very healthy community.
In a way, the project has the potential to perpetuate itself.
That is correct, both through launching new investigators, but also to help us make a justification for this ongoing infrastructure support that could not only be supported through a federal agency like this grant is at this time, but also through foundations and other sources where enlightened individuals see that the solution is going to have to be holistic. It's going to have to bring those with different professions together. And most importantly, it's going to have to be driven by the needs of the community, and the community's voice has to be involved.
Dr. Jairus Hedges is a professor and dean of medicine at the University of Hawaii's John A. Burns School of Medicine and a project leader for the new five-year, $23 million federal grant to Hawaii that will create the Ola Hawaii Center for Research. Earlier in the show, we hiked out to an ancient place along the Hana coast on the Valley Isle. It's surrounded by clearings, groves of coconut palms, native hala or pandanus, and varieties of colorful ulu or breadfruit trees. We asked you about an ancient heiau that sits on a mammoth 3-acre platform, boasting 50-foot retaining walls. It dates back to the 13th century. In 1998, archaeologists from the Bishop Museum and the State of Hawaii undertook a major stabilization project. Maui stonemasons utilized traditional methods to restack the terraced walls of the heiau, and the restoration work was completed in 1999. Today, you can see the Pi'ilani Hale Heiau for yourself inside Kahanu Garden, one of five gardens that make up the National Tropical Botanical Garden on Maui. And our winner is Summer Star of Makawao. This is a popular quiz today. The bulk of the calls were from Maui, our former Valley Isle residents. But Summer Star was the firstest with the mostest. She's the winner of today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is Jason Taglianetti, host of Applause in a Small Room. This year in the Atherton Studio, we presented concerts and conversations with amazing musical artists from around the world and around our islands. Your gift ensures that we will continue to have a place where we can come together and celebrate the power of music. Whether you find that place on our air or at our live gatherings, please support HPR today. Donate through the HPR mobile app. Thanks, and happy holidays.
Taimane has taken her music beyond displays of her skill on the ukulele to reflect a broader vision as she recruits artists from other media to help her present it. Her shows can be counted on to appeal to a variety of our senses, and she's in the studio to perform some of the tunes she's preparing for tomorrow's evening's holiday fete. With her is her guitarist, Jazzy Skirtu. Taimane, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
You've always had a strong visual component to your shows. What prompted that?
I always feel I like the full experience when I perform, either watching or performing. I feel the audience needs the whole ambiance along with the music, because the music is telling a story, so why not also bring that visual aspect into it?
Why not illustrate the story while you're at it, right?
Exactly. You know, and the fun thing about this is that we're going to be including food, one of my favorites, so it'll be a feast for all the senses.
Food how? You mean serving dishes? Or?
Yeah, so we're working together with Fet Restaurant. They are one of my favorite ones in Chinatown. And, I you know, we came up with this idea of putting together a holiday show, and why not collaborate with another artist such as Fet Restaurant. And so there will be a full course meal along with music. We're also having samadhi aerial dancers and some minglers as fun. So it should be a fun evening overall.
What are minglers?
People who dress up as characters and who can play around with you a little bit.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's something that very few other artists can offer. That's a interesting idea.
Yeah, just some characters around just to keep the energy up and to have fun and, you know, make sure everyone's enjoying the food and the energy all around.
Minglers, all right.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we want to give as much time as possible to your music. So what have you got for us?
Well, of course, we always have to do a medley of sorts. And so we're going to start off with Green Sleeves and then head over to God Rest Ye Gentlemen.
Sounds good.
Here we go.
Terrific.
Thank you.
You know, tempo changes, time signature changes. You two are really well attuned to each other.
We are. We've been playing together for about 8 years, and we have fun.
Sounds like it. Sounds like it.
Yes.
Listen, I think we've got time for another song.
Sure. We're going to do another holiday song for you. This one is my favorite Christmas song. It is called Carol of the Bells, and of course we have to make it crazy. So I hope you guys enjoy Carol of the Bells.
Thank you.
was really impressive, Tamani.
Thank you.
Jazzy Skirtu on guitar. That was wonderful, really.
Thank you.
As
so
you
much.
Said, you as of course you have to make it crazy, but you really like to take a song and take it somewhere, don't you?
Definitely. And I look forward to, I'm going to have the dancers, I'm going to have the food, so it should be a fun evening overall tomorrow night.
I don't doubt it for a minute. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Ukulele artist Taimani will perform Taimani's Holiday Fete tomorrow at the Arts at Mark's Garage in downtown Honolulu. You can get more information on our conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui and Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
And that's it for this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, we'll meet the Waialua teacher who is shortlisted for a $1 million teaching award. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. If you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find our playlist at hawaiipublicradio.org, where you can also listen back to today's show. The program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale. The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us on Monday.